December 3rd, 1967. Some of you, I won't ask who, but some of you will remember that date. December 3rd, 1967, 53-year-old Louis Washkansky, I hope I'm saying his name right, received the first human heart transplant. Some of you may remember this event, as I said earlier. Louis was dying from a chronic heart disease, and he received the transplant from a 25-year-old woman who was fatally injured in a car accident. The surgeon was trained at Cape Town, South Africa, and in the United States. He performed this revolutionary new medical procedure. And when Bernard, Louis, was given the new heart, you had the world's first successful heart transplant in a human. I think it was 9 years earlier they had completed one in a dog. And so you have here the first successful heart transplant, but as some of you have known, maybe through family members or through experience of yourself, when you get a transplant, you also have to take pills. What is it for? Yeah, because your body wants to reject it, right? Well, the development wasn't that great back then, and he ended up dying 18 days after the heart transplant due to double pneumonia. It had nothing to do with the heart not being good. Despite the setback, as I said, in the 1970s, better anti-rejection drugs would be made, and this transplant surgery would be more so known today, where the hardest thing isn't keeping people alive. The hardest thing is finding a good donor today. So with this in mind, the reality is we know of people who have had heart transplants. We hear of it. It's kind of not normal, like everybody does it, but when we hear someone gets it, it's kind of a normal thing now. The hard part is finding the heart to replace it with. And the reason I start off this way is because just like some people's hearts physically are in such bad shape that they need a totally new one, if you've been along in our study, you've heard that your heart, spiritually, is also in such a bad shape that it requires a transplant, if you will, a totally new heart. You do not need God to fix your heart. You need Him to replace it. I don't want Him to come and clean up things. I want Him to make me a new what? Creature, 2 Corinthians 5, right? I want to be new. I don't want to be refreshed. As we've seen, our heart is prideful, deceitful, fat, hard, lacking integrity. It's divided. It's not upright. It's not truthful. It's impure. It's easily losing hope. There's a lot of defects on our heart. And all that is rooted in what event in history? What caused the human heart to go that way? The fall. Okay, so if you are a human being born of man and woman after the fall, this is your heart. If you don't see this in yourself, I would suggest you have too high of a view of yourself. This means that we need to be changed as human beings. We need a new heart in order to not just become what Jesus called whitewashed tombs. What was the whole problem with the Pharisees' righteousness? It was all outward, right? They were cleaning up the outside of the tomb. Inward was dead man's bones. When we suggest changes for people to pursue righteousness without stressing the need to be born again, we're just helping them become whitewashed tombs. That's why in counseling, we talk about there really is no counseling to a real effect until there's conversion. All counseling before conversion is just whitewashing a tomb. That's all you're doing. And so what is our hope for real change? Is it even possible? My original intention when I started thinking about what's our hope for change was to do another lesson on something we've done before. But I kind of need to get moving because we've cut this quarter a little short with Christmas and New Year's. We take off the last two Sundays of the year for New Year's, Christmas and New Year's. I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. Last two Sunday schools. Don't want to start that rumor, yeah. We take off the last two Sunday schools. So in order to get moving, I wanted to make a reference to something I've taught before, that if you don't grasp that, you're going to be frustrated whitewashing a tomb the whole time. And if you'll remember, it was a year ago this time where I was talking about distinctives of Cornerstone Bible Church, and one of them I talked about is when we distinguish between what we call a general outward call and an effectual inward call. Okay, when we present the gospel, we're making a general outward call. I will give the gospel to everyone because I can guarantee you that if anyone believes and repents, they will be saved. And why is that? Because God, what? God said they would. God's not a liar, okay? But there's an internal effectual call I can't produce in somebody. Jesus in John 3 compared it to what? Do you remember? In John 3, what did Jesus say? It's like the what? The wind. You don't know where it's coming or going, but you can see its effects. And so when you're preaching the gospel, when you're witnessing to people, when you're praying for people, you're doing all these things that are right and necessary, but you know as well as I do, you have no ability to turn the light on for people, right? You have no ability to take that heart out and give them a new one. That is not in your hands, and it's also not your responsibility. And so I taught on that about a year ago, one lesson on, external call, general call, meaning it's our job, it's what we're doing, it's outward, it's for everybody. But then there's an internal, effectual call that is done only by God. If you're interested in more of that, I would say go back and listen to that. I think it's on the website titled Effectual Calling, I think is what it's called. But if you wanted more of a introduction, and I know I'm holding this book up saying introduction, what you need to realize is this book has a lot of small chapters in it, right? So that's what I'm doing. But if you look on this, if you have this book, I would encourage you to read pages 576 to 589. This book here is extremely helpful, and in fact, one of my good friends wrote the chapter on salvation. And the chapter was so good that the people who published this, Crossway, approached him about pulling that chapter out and making it its own book. I mean, this is the chapter on salvation in this book is excellent. But specifically with what we're talking about with changing and the need to be born again, I'll give you this little teaser. If someone asks, how can I be born again? And you say, by believing, you don't understand what it means to be born again. Okay? That's kind of a teaser for you to go listen. Some of you will remember what we talked about with that. So again, this is very helpful. Page 576 to 589. If that's not enough for you, this is one of my favorite books on what it means to be born again. It's by John Piper. It's called Finally Alive. And again, with all three of these books I'll talk about, they're written by men. They're not inspired. Are there areas we may disagree with? Sure, no problem. You know, so just know that with every purely human book I give you. But this book here, Finally Alive by John Piper, is one of the most helpful books as I was studying this idea of being born again, regeneration, being made new. How does that happen? What does it do to me? This is, to me, one of the most helpful books. In fact, he goes, one particular chapter that was really helpful was going through John 3 and talking about the conversation between Nicodemus and Jesus. For those of you who are more glutton for punishment, here is, again, another doorstopper. This is a book, if your house gets attacked, you want to have it because bullets will not penetrate this, right? You want plenty of these around your house. This is a book here by a guy named Matthew Barrett. It's called Salvation by Grace. And what he does is he goes through this book talking about what we believe about effectual calling and this idea of regeneration and what distinguishes what we would call the Reformed view of effectual calling and regeneration from other views like a Wesleyan view. He kind of goes through the history of it, takes you through a ton of text. This is one that I've referenced a lot, and I love this book, but for most of you, your best bet's going to be reading this one or reading this one here. This one is so easy to read. It's a very easy, quick read. You'll breeze right through it. So I would suggest that. I'm not going to talk this morning about being born again. I'm going to talk more about addressing you as a Christian, addressing you as someone who has been made new, as someone who now has the ability and the desire, to whatever degree it is, you have the ability and desire to put off and put on, right? I'm not going to deal with the need to be born again because we've dealt with it so many times before, but if you're not familiar with that, I would encourage you to go listen or read some of these sources. The bottom line is this: all of our hope for change is rooted in the fact that God promised us a new heart. I have to receive a new heart from God, and I use that language carefully. I am passive in this idea of Him causing me to be born again. He alone does this work. He does it in His own timing, and He does it in His own power. There is a moment even if you're fuzzy on when that moment was. You know, a lot of times people will say, well, what was the date, time, temperature, what car were you in? Like, they want all these little details about the moment you were saved. I'm okay with people not always remembering the exact moment, right? When I got saved, I didn't immediately go to my diary and write down exactly the temperature of the room and everything, okay? There's a helpful book called Stop Asking Jesus Into Your Heart. He compares getting saved to sitting in a chair. And he says, far more important than knowing when you're sitting in the chair is what? When did you start sitting in the chair is secondary to, are you sitting in the chair? Does that make sense? Before we worry about when did you start sitting, let's just worry about, are you even sitting? And then we can worry about the other stuff later. So I say this because this work of regeneration may be something, I'll just tell you, for me, it wasn't until six months later that I realized, looking back, oh, that's what happened that night. So I wouldn't have been like, I just got born again. Like, I wouldn't have known that at that moment. I wouldn't have had the words to say. I wouldn't have understood things like I later would understand them. So your ultimate hope, as I'm getting at, though, is rooted in this work of God. This morning, I want to start moving in more of the direction of what's our responsibility as Christians. But know, again, that you're only able to practice this process of change and improve, if you will, because of the work God's already done in your life. Any growth in holiness, true godliness, not just doing the right thing, but doing the right thing from the right heart motive for God's glory, that process is only possible because of the work of regeneration God's already worked in your life. At your new birth, God calls you to come to spiritual life. Before that, Ephesians 2, we were what? Dead in trespasses and sins. I want to begin addressing this morning and weeks to come how to start living in this new life. We've been talking a lot about the heart, a lot about your heart is fueled by what's there. We'll talk a little bit more about that this morning. But I want to get more into how do we start changing things. I want to address you, as I said, as Christians. The things I'm going to say this morning for people who aren't Christians is just going to be frustrating. It's just this, and it's also kind of like the carrot dangling on the stick. If you promise change now, and let's just say someone's life does get easier, but they go to hell, I just feel like that's one of the most deceptive things we can do. So I want to be careful here, and I want to address you as Christians. Everything I'll say about change will cause nothing, as I said earlier, but false hope and frustration for those who haven't been born again. This heart change that we as believers have had and everyone on earth needs causes us, and this is one of the reasons I like the title of this book, it's called Finally Alive. Like, this is the way life's supposed to live. Truly loving God from my heart, truly loving others from my heart, with no dual mask, if you will. I'm not hiding things. Like I actually do love the Bible. Like, have any of you ever sat there and thought about that before? Like, I actually do. Like, I love the Bible. That's the way life is supposed to be lived. You love listening to God. That was what you were created to do. So no matter who you are, no matter what you've done, no matter how many sinful habits you've accumulated through the years, no matter how many times you've been disobedient in the same area over and over, God promises that post-rebirth, you can change. Like, that is absolutely his goal and his plan. This morning, I want to begin, as I said earlier, to talk about how that change happens. Next week, Seth, unless I'm misassessing this, you can correct me, please do. But next week, I was kind of talking with Seth about what to do, and one of his ideas helped me with this whole thing is sometimes we get so introspective in sanctification that it's harmful. Like, man, I am lousy. Like, it's like, I don't want to stay inside of ourselves for the next 6-7 weeks, whatever it is, right? I want to remember what's true outside of myself, that no matter how frustrated I get in sanctification, this is still true. So Seth is going to talk about something from Hebrews, and this gives it away, obviously, but something that someone accomplished that 100% guarantees your glorification. And your glorification is none other than just the completion of your sanctification. This process we get so frustrated with, I've been saying over and over, it's guaranteed to be finished. Seth will talk a little bit more about that. How is it that me, as such a lousy Christian at times, I'm still guaranteed God will completely perfect me? Well, he'll talk about that next week. And then I'll come back and I want to talk about some more practical, tangible ways that we can begin this heart change from our role, if you will. But first, remember this. What determines the heart's actions? I'm sorry? Signal from the brain. Yeah, okay. But if we're dealing with your life is fueled by your heart, well, what fuels your heart? What's in it, right? It's that simple. If you go down to one of these easy storage buildings, what can you pull out of that storage facility? What's in it? And if it's your building, guess who put it there? You put it there. It's like, this is what we're dealing with. This is the depth of my illustrations, if you will. Our heart is sort of like a storage facility. You will only pull out of it what you put into it. Things can be stored into your heart, and they can be stored in the very front by the door. You open the door, it's pretty easy to get out, right? There's other things, and you guys know this, when you do your spring cleaning, it's like, oh man, how am I going to get back there to that? I remember when we were gutting this room behind the stage here, I can remember approaching it and going, this is not going to happen. It is a wreck. And then all of a sudden, through some hard labor, right, and some flying nails and boards and stabbing and all kinds of other stuff, we were able to get it cleaned out. The idea, you enter that storage facility, there's little bitty boxes in the very front that are very easy to get, but it's going to take a while to get some of the things in the back, right? Some of the heavier boxes, I'm going to need help with this. Some of the things we even forgot we put back there will start to show up. Just as we live and grow off of our physical environment, what you eat, what you breathe, what you are around, you live and grow off your spiritual environment. You put healthy stuff in, life gets better, right? You put junk in, life gets harder. But where this analogy breaks down, and I'm sure it breaks down in more than one spot, is your heart's not just an empty storage facility. Your heart is born stuffed full of sinful desires. And the things you want to put in there are sinful. And so it's like, okay, now that I have a new heart, I need to start asking the question, not just what am I doing, but why am I doing that? Get behind the what to the why. It's one thing to recognize you've got a problem with lust. It's another to address the heart and go, why is this drawing me so much? What is it in my heart that is loving this? What's going on? And that's what I want to get at. Your heart is born full of sinful things, not just an empty storage facility that's blank until you decide what goes in it. That's where the illustration kind of falls down. So not only do we need to think about what things are filling our heart, we need to think about the reasons we're wanting to put those things in there in the first place. Our heart is always in the process of drawing itself towards what it loves. This is so easy to understand. What are the easiest things for you to do in your life? The things that you what? Love. I mean, some of you, I could be like, hey, I got 2 Chiefs tickets. And it would not take much arm twisting, right? I'll pick on Tyler just because I know him very well. If I had a Nike shirt, Dave, Janine, what would he say? I don't want it, right? Because KU is Adidas. I'm sorry, I say KU. K-State is Adidas, I think. Or no, I'll get backwards. K-State is Nike and KU is Adidas. So Tyler loves KU to a certain degree where he won't wear Nike clothing. And it's like, it's easy to tell what he loves because loving Adidas is just that easy because he loves KU that much. Anyway, you get the idea. It's not hard for you to do things in your life because those are the things you want to do. The things that are hard to do in our life are the things we don't really love all that much. Raking leaves and changing diapers. I throw that one in there, just hypothetical. Not anything personal right now. But you get the idea. Is I don't have to twist your arm to do everything you do in your life. There are some things that you got to twist my arm to do. Or like I'll say yes, but inside I'm like, I'll do it. And again, it's because of this truth that your heart is always drawing itself to what it loves. If your heart doesn't love it, it's not going to easily draw itself to it. All of our hearts are dominated by what it loves. Turn to Matthew 6. Matthew 6, Jesus speaks about the heart. I'll have to apologize to Tyler later for saying that KU wore Nike. But all of our hearts are dominated by what they love. It will draw you closer and closer until you actually get what you love. Look at this. Jesus, I'm going to show you a verse here in a second. Some of you will know this verse when I say it, but Jesus did not say, Where your heart is, that's where your treasure will be. He didn't say that where your heart is, that's where your treasure will be. Look at Matthew 6:21. For where your treasure is, what? That's where your heart will be. Your heart is fueled by what's in it, and what's in it because your heart loves it. Your heart will always serve a master. Look at Matthew 6:24. No one can serve two masters. It's literally, you guys have heard this several times, no one can be a slave to two masters. You go to a restaurant, people wait on all kinds of tables, right? They can wait on 3, 4, 5, 6 tables. When you're dealing with slavery, you cannot be a slave to two masters. He says, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money, or mammon in some of your other translations. Jesus is making it clear that your heart will be dominated by what? What it treasures, what it loves. So again, we've got to get to this idea of, well, why does my heart want what it wants? It's not just a thing of saying, what is it that I'm wanting? It's, why am I wanting these things? A heart lives, and this again, this is my fourth and fifth grade analogy, if you will. Our heart lives somewhat like the plant experiment we've probably all done, right? You cut off a flower, you put it in water, and you put food coloring in the water, and what happens? Whatever color food coloring you put in, red, those white petals become red, right? Because it's drawing from the red water, and it's drawing, and whatever's in that water is what the flower becomes like. Eventually, the water comes up, the water leaves, but the color stays. And similarly, you are drawing from your heart. Whatever's in your heart, whatever your heart wants, all these things, this is what you are as a person. If you put, as I said, that food coloring in there, it doesn't take very long to see the effects of it on the outside. So it is with the mind or the heart, if you will. I want to ask again this morning, how can I change the content of my heart? This is, I'll just be honest with you. I told you my friend here wrote the chapter on salvation. I was on the phone with him, I guess it was Thursday, for about 45 minutes, talking to him about some of these concepts, because it's hard. And here's what drives me most bonkers, is in Scripture, it's true that what drives us, what is it that makes me want and do what I want to do? We've been talking about it for a whole quarter. What is it? The heart, right? Well, at the same time in Scripture, I'm commanded to put things in my heart. And so you kind of see this endless cycle of, wait, my heart drives me, but I feel my heart, and my heart drives me, and I feel my heart. I just don't understand. That's a difficult concept for me. And so as I go through this, understand, I'm trying to work some of these things out as well. So what I want to show you this morning is this idea that we are commanded to direct the director, is kind of one of the titles I've given to it. As you are commanded to direct the director. That kind of hit on the awkwardness a little bit for me. First, I want to show you, again, we've talked about this, so I won't spend a ton of time on it. There's one new aspect I haven't talked about. But what is it that actually fills our hearts? Turn to Proverbs 19. Proverbs 19, as we read this, pay attention to what he says, because I want you to tell me what it is that fills our hearts. Proverbs 19. Proverbs 19, verse 21. Many are the what? Plans in the mind of a man. Remember, no Hebrew word for brain. What word is this? If it says mind in the Old Testament, it's heart, lev, heart. Many are the plans of the heart of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand. So here, Proverbs 19, 21, what is one of the things that fills your heart? Plans, thoughts, desires. There's many other verses. We've talked about that before, though. Look, secondly, at Proverbs 12. Not only can thoughts, plans, and desires fill your heart, but we've talked about this already as well, emotions and passions. Proverbs 12. Proverbs 12, verse 25. Anxiety in a man's what? Heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. Again, not only can your heart plan and think and desire, but it can also be anxious. Jesus said this, right? Upper room discourse. He says, let your heart not be troubled. Again, we see that idea. James 3, to get a little New Testament flavor on this. And just total side note, but as we read this, if you've ever studied the book of James, you'll not see any other New Testament book outside the Gospels sound so much like Jesus. James is one of the most words of Jesus dependent book without actually quoting him that there is. James is very dependent on the same exact things. I don't mean, like, Paul agrees with Jesus, obviously. I'm not saying that there are other books that contradict Jesus. I'm not saying that. But it's almost like James just took the Sermon on the Mount stuff and was just like, here's my letter. There's very similar things here. But look at James 3, speaking of taming the tongue, and he talks about wisdom from above. Verse 14, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your what? Heart, or hearts, do not boast and be false to the truth. Again, the idea is your heart can store up a whole lot of things. Thoughts, desires, plans, emotions, passions. Philippians 1, here's something else that we haven't talked about yet. It's kind of an odd concept, but you'll understand it. Philippians 1, 7. Not only can inanimate things, a thought or plan, a desire, emotion, a passion, but also people can be in our hearts. Philippians 1, look at verse 3. I'll just start 3. I just love this, so we'll start early. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine, for you all, making my prayer with joy because of your partnership in the gospel from the first day until now. So real quick, what is Paul saying he's doing right now? What did we just read? Huh? I can't hear you. Okay, he's thanking God for these people. Okay? He's praying to God for these people. Verse 6. And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. In one sense, and this is one of the concepts, you know, I personally try to work on. We often see Paul extremely happy for the good of others. And here we see Paul praying and thanking God that their sanctification is going to be complete. Just another concept here. Look at verse 7. It is right for me to feel this way about you all because I hold you, where? In my heart. So again, people can be in your heart. Now that person is not omnipresent. That person's not in your heart. That person is in your heart, meaning the impressions they leave. This can be good and bad. Look at 1 John 3. There's obviously a different sense that God can be in your heart. He is omnipresent. He is a lot of things that we are not. But for men to be in our heart seems to be this idea of an impression left on us that changes our thoughts, emotions, behaviors based on our relationship with them. 1 John 3, look at verse 16. By this we know, love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought lay down our lives for the brothers. Real quick, just to further stress this whole heart thing. How do you know that Jesus' love for you was actually a real love from his heart? Yeah, you watch him. It's like pretty easy. So again, you even know from that the heart fuels the life. I can tell you truly loved me because of watching you. Look what he says in verse 17. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes what? His heart against him. How does God's love abide in him? It's one thing to say you love someone. It's another one to open your heart to them and show them that you love them. And that's what he's getting at here. So thoughts, desires, a bunch of inanimate things, but also people can be in our hearts. But what I want to do with the rest of our time is think about this. With what's in your heart, let's go back to the storage facility. You open it up. You're going to wonder sometimes, Who put this in here? It's one thing for me to say, on one level, you did, absolutely. But there's another level where there's a couple different actors, if you will, in this play. And I want to talk about that this morning, because if we're going to understand how to change the heart, we've got to know, where do these things in our heart, who put them there? It's one thing just to surface level say, well, I did. But I want to deal with a little bit deeper issue. And talking about this is going to help you see that change is possible. And I have to stop here and just ask, I don't need a verbal response, but do you actually believe you can change? I'm not trying to get Osteen-ish up here, positive thinking, but the reality is if you're living your Christian life just clinging on for dear life until glory, you're probably not going to change. A lot of this has to do with if you believe God's word, you can change. You actually can do it. No matter what the state of your heart is when you're converted, the new heart you received is actually able to put off and put on. Whatever sin remains at our death is not the fault of our new heart. It's not the fault of God. It's us. So do you believe this? Do you actually believe that you actually can change? A lot of the battle is won there, if you will. A lot of people just aren't seeking to change because they just really don't think it's going to happen. Look, I'm 50-something years old. I've been doing this for years. I'm just going to believe the gospel and just wait on the Lord to change this. None of you would settle for this. If a husband is in the airport and he goes, you know what? Everybody deals with lust. I'll just embrace it and wait on the Lord to change it. Wait a second. That's not our approach to the Christian life. So again, my question is, do you actually believe this change is possible? Or are you kind of in coasting mode? I want to encourage you with this. You may see faster changes in your life in certain areas. There are some things that when I got saved, within an hour or two were different. Within a week or two, there were other differences. There are still things today that we're still waiting on to be different, right? So it's kind of that whole thing of you open the door to your storage shed, and it's pretty easy to get some of those things out, right? Now, what's kind of discouraging is you look at someone else's shed, and the boxes that were easy for you to get out, they look and go, man, those boxes for me are way bigger and further in the back. And so it's like, well, I might not be a Christian because it was really easy for you to get rid of that, but it's hard for me. And then you look over and you see boxes you have in the back that you know you're going to need big help with. And you look over and there's just this little tiny box he just pulled out really easily. I mean, just one for instance. I'm not picking on anybody or boasting or anything. I just never drank, like growing up. I just didn't do it. So guess what was really easy for me when I'm a Christian? To obey, don't get drunk. It's just not hard. I've just never wanted to. I'm not saying I'm better. It's just with my storage facility, I've got bigger boxes in the back that you don't have, and drunkenness may be yours, right? There are actually Christians who actually struggle to not get drunk. It's not that hard of a concept. We can't pick on someone else's sin and go, well, I don't have a problem with it. You know, I can say this now because he's in heaven and he can actually hear me now, my grandpa, but I mean, I'm not getting into whether they can hear me, but with a glorified body, I won't have to stress as much. You know, that whole thing. But I remember talking to Papa, and one of the hard things for him, and this is what we got to be careful of, when he started to have grandkids, my grandma told him, quit smoking. He smoked over 2.5 packs a day. That's a lot of smoking. I've done the math. You got to sleep at some point, right? I don't think he had it in while he was sleeping. He smoked a lot. And when those grandkids came along and Mama Rose said, stop smoking, he quit cold turkey. Okay. And never wanted another one. That's not normal, right? Am I alone here? That's not normal. So someone who's trying to kick that habit, he would look at them and go, just stop. Like, what are you doing? He just couldn't comprehend that you can't just stop. And so sometimes in our life, it's easy for us to get rid of certain things, and we lose patience with people who aren't as good at getting rid of those things that were easy for us. Does that make sense? You want to be careful of that. Everyone has their Hebrews 12, if you will, the things that so easily entangle us. You know, or there's just certain sins for you that just are easier to get entangled in than for me. I say that because you may see faster changes in your life in some areas, but then there's other things that are more deeply rooted in your heart that take longer to change. And you may see areas in another person's life that aren't as deeply rooted and they're really deep in yours, and it's easy for them and hard for you, and you think, okay, well, maybe I'm not really a Christian because they change really quickly. Just be careful with that thinking. Everyone has lived not just a lot of life, but a different life up to the point you're at right now. Your change will vary depending on the issue you're changing. I don't think it's hard for a lot of people in here to not murder, right? Now, it's hard to not hate. Like, it's not hard to be sinfully, it's hard to not be sinfully angry. That's something that we can all deal with. But all believers can change by this idea of changing the content of your heart. So again, I want to end our time here by thinking, who puts things into our hearts? I've got a lot of verses to flip through just because I want it to be very clear for you. First and foremost, Scripture teaches that God puts things in our heart. Look at Jeremiah 31. I've got a long list of things that prove each of these points, but I'll only read a couple verses. For instance, when they were building the building in the Old Testament, God put skill and ability in some of the Israelites. First Kings, he put wisdom. Ecclesiastes, he put the concept of eternity in man's heart. Psalm 4, he put gladness in man's heart. 2 Corinthians 8, he put earnestness in man's heart. God also causes the heart to have certain attributes. He gives fatness of heart in Job 23. He gives strength to the heart in Psalm 10. Psalm 105, he also turns your heart towards things. God is very active in your heart. Jeremiah 31, here we are in some of the language involving this new covenant. If you are a Christian, you're in the new covenant. Look at Jeremiah 31, 33. But this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declaring, I will put my law, where? Within them. And I will write it on their what? Hearts. So the moment you're born again, there's a certain connection with God's word that you didn't ask for. It's just that's the heart he created you with. The heart that I give you at the new birth is a heart that loves my word. It's also a heart, well, you can see elsewhere in Jeremiah 31, a heart that fears him. That's why universal, Christians may disagree on a whole lot of things, but you will not find a Christian who doesn't love God's word and doesn't fear God. I mean, that's two of the most basic things that God promised I will put in your heart as a new creature. And so you see that there. You didn't see him saying, when you ask for it, I'll do it. It's just, I will do it. Jeremiah 32, this is what I was referencing with the fear. Look at Jeremiah 32. Verse 38, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. I will give them one heart and one way that they may fear me forever for their own good and the good of their children after them. I will make with them an everlasting covenant, and I will not turn away from doing good to them. And I will put the fear of me, where? In their hearts, that they may not turn from me. Now, we may have some difficulty explaining what it means, but it's not a hard concept that every single person that's truly born again fears God. It's not even arguable. I don't coach you to do that. Now, you can learn to increase that fear, but there's a natural, a new birth natural, if you will, fear of God and love for his word that I didn't ask for. This is the heart he gave me. But the reason we love it so much is because we know that's what's best for us. Also, Deuteronomy 2, look at this. As I said, we're going to be flipping a lot. If you just want to write it down, it's okay. But if you want to see it, you can flip with us. Deuteronomy 2. This is an interesting text. I was going to read just verse 30, but look at verse 26. I want you to get the concept here, because this is a God-expanding text, if you will. What I mean by that is there's just certain verses that you stumble on and you go, I have never thought of that before in my life. God's a whole lot bigger than what I thought he was. Look at verse 26. So I sent messengers from the wilderness to Kedmoth, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, the words of peace, saying, let me pass through your land. I will go only by the road. I will turn aside, neither to the right nor to the left. You shall sell me food for money that I may eat, and give me water for money that I may drink. Only let me pass through on foot, as the sons of Esau who live in Seir and Moabites who live in Ar did for me, until I go over the Jordan into the land that the Lord our God is giving us. So God's saying, ask for safe passage. Say, you'll do this. I'll give you money. Give us food. I'll give you money. Give us drink. We're just going to pass through on foot. Verse 30. But Sihon, the king of Heshbon, would not let us pass by him. Real quick. Who is responsible for not letting them pass by? Sihon, right? There's no question about this. Said he would not let us pass by him, because the Lord your God hardened his spirit and made his heart obstinate that he might give him into your hand as he is this day. So the Lord says, go ask him to pass by, but I'm going to make his heart obstinate and he's not going to let you pass by. You're going to battle, you're going to overcome him, and he'll be in your hands. Wait a second. You mean God can just determine if someone's heart rejects the request of somebody else? Absolutely. Again, it's one thing to say, well, I disagree. I don't think God does that. It's another one to explain, well, what does this actually mean then? Because he said he did. Look at, if you will, 1 Kings 3. 1 Kings 3. Sometimes God does things in concert, if you will, with someone else. Not always. There are some things that God does on his own. For instance, every human being has eternity in their hearts. They didn't ask for it. It's there, right? There are other things that even as a Christian, like there wasn't a moment in time where I said, Lord, give me a heart. So he just gave me the heart, right? So there's some things that don't happen in concert with us. But 1 Kings 3, you're familiar with this story. With Solomon's prayer for wisdom. Look at verse 9, though. This is what he asked for. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind. Again, not mind. What is the word? Heart. It's literally, an understanding mind is literally a listening heart. Solomon asked God, please give me a listening heart. And so we see again God able to cause people's hearts to listen to him. Other things, as I said, are given without their cooperation. Here's an example where Solomon asked and Solomon received. But not only is God able to put things in our heart, we ourselves are as well. Go back to Jeremiah 12. Jeremiah 12. And basically my verses that I'm reading here kind of just show the responsibility God puts on people when something is in their heart. Or if their heart doesn't have something it should, he puts the responsibility on them. We also, as I said, cause our hearts to be set on something. David, in 1 Samuel 2, David was asked to ignore something. She literally says, please don't set your heart on this. Israel was judged because they paid no attention to some of the judgment from God. Look at Jeremiah 12, you'll see this. Verse 10, many shepherds have destroyed my vineyard. They have trampled down my portion. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. They have made it a desolation, desolate. It mourns to me. The whole land is made desolate, but no man, what? Lays it to heart. And the idea is pays attention to it. So you see the responsibility on the Israelites. They are the ones ignoring and not taking to heart what God's doing. Ezekiel 20. Ezekiel 20. Rather than taking it to heart like they should have, look at what their heart was doing. And again, you see the responsibility put on man. Ezekiel 20, verse 15. Moreover, I swore to them in the wilderness that I would not bring them into the land that I had given them, a land flowing with milk and honey, the most glorious of all lands, because they rejected my rules. Real quick, what's another way? If you're playing crossword puzzle, right? And it's looking for an O word, and the clue is rejected rules. They're not obeying, right? Disobedience. I guess it would be a D word, sorry. They're disobeying. Look what he says, verse 16. Because they rejected my rules, they disobeyed, and did not walk in my statutes, they disobeyed, and profaned my Sabbaths, they disobeyed, for or because their heart went after idols. The idea is you see their disobedience rooted in their heart chasing things. And God doesn't say, yeah, but they can't control what's in their heart anyway, so I'm not going to judge them. No, he brings the full force of judgment on them because they are responsible for what's in their heart. Here's another encouraging one that we've seen in Daniel. Go to your right and go to Daniel. Daniel 1. This is, like I said, an encouraging one because you see someone doing the right thing with their heart, although in the text it says something a little different than we're used to. Daniel 1, you're familiar with Daniel. Daniel was taken captive, and he made a special request. Do you remember when he was in prison? What was his request? Anybody remember what it was? Say what? It's the opposite of kids, right? It's, I don't want to eat anything but vegetables, right? It's like, well, I wish my kid would be like Daniel. No, you get the idea. Again, I'll remind you, Romans 14, weak people in faith eat vegetables. But I'm just telling you. Daniel 1, verse 8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's what? food. The idea is when Daniel made the special request to have a special diet, right? It says he resolved. The idea behind that word resolved is not the Hebrew word for resolved. It's he set his heart on. Again, we see Daniel making a firm stance. He's got not just a strong conviction, but one that literally puts his life on the line. I mean, not only are you getting the best food in the land, because it's the king's food, but also you're a prisoner. Who are you to make requests to us? I mean, here's Daniel putting his life on the line, and it all is rooted in this fact that he set his heart not to defile himself. And so we see very clearly here this idea of we ourselves, along with God, can place things in our heart. Look back at Ezekiel. Go back to your left one book. Ezekiel 3. Look what God tells his watchman here, if you will. Ezekiel 3, verse 10. Ezekiel 3, verse 10. Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, all my words that I shall speak to you, do what? Receive in your what? Heart. So again, he's commanding him to put something in his heart. Take the words I'm giving you and put them in your heart. To those who receive God's word in their heart, he promises very clearly in Proverbs that wisdom will follow. But not only does God and we ourselves put things in our heart, there's also the reality that other people put things in our heart. And I want to say before I read these verses, this goes without saying, but I have to say it. People can only put in your heart what you receive and give it a comfortable place to stay. Does that make sense? It's not like I can come to you and go, you're a banana, and all of a sudden in your heart you believe you're a banana. Like, it's not what I'm getting at. But the reality is, our hearts tend to cling to the wrong things, right? Our hearts tend to believe lies. Our hearts tend to be faint. And so when someone comes along with bad advice, or someone comes along with false things that they're saying, and I don't know the truth, it's very easy for me to cling to what they're saying. So in one sense, yes, we're still the ones who put it there, but I want to read these verses because it talks about people who put bad things into other people's hearts. Look at Numbers 32. You'll see what I'm getting at. What I don't want this to be is a blame game of, well, I wouldn't believe this if you hadn't said it, because ultimately you received it. But again, I don't want to ignore the fact that the things people say can be received and placed into your heart. Numbers 32. Verses 8 and 9. It says, your fathers did this when I sent them to Kadesh Barnea to see the land. For when they went up to the valley of Eshcol and saw the land, they discouraged the heart of the people of Israel from going into the land that the Lord God had given them. How did they discourage the people from entering? Does anybody remember? Who did they send in? Remember they sent in the 12 spies, and 10 of them came back with a what? A bad report. And guess who was discouraged in their heart? The people who listened to that bad report. So there's a real sense to where I can say those 10 put that in their heart. But in reality, the reason it's in their heart is because they received what they said. They didn't trust the Lord. Instead, they took what this person said over here. Look at Genesis 31. Again, I'm not trying to get rid of responsibility for us, but we do need to recognize the things going on around us. Genesis 31, in Hebrew again, we'll read in English to deceive someone. Look at Genesis 31. Genesis 31, verse 20. And Jacob tricked Laban and Aramean by not telling him that he intended to flee. So someone can withhold information and trick you. ESV, I don't know about your translation, but ESV has a footnote. And for trick, the footnote is what? Does anybody see it? It's like size 3 font. What is it? Stole the heart. That's what it means to deceive someone. So this person withheld information, and the Hebrew literally says stole their heart. Again, we see the influence other people can have. And this is even true of Satan. Now, I am not a believer that Satan can put things into your mind without you wanting it to be there. But the reality is, if you don't know the truth, if you aren't firm in your faith, if you aren't well grounded, the lies that Satan produces, you can easily cling to. And you can easily go, well, that's not true. Well, I know God said this, but I think I ought to do this. Those are very easy to see. James 4 commands you to resist the devil. So it's clear that our heart is driven by what's in it, and hopefully you see now that what's in our heart comes not only by God, not only by others, but even ourselves. And ultimately, we are the ones who are held responsible, because the only way something can sit down in my heart is if I've cleaned off the seat and helped it sit down. Here, be at home here. It's clear, again, that there are many agents used in this process of what's in my heart. So I just want to read what I have here at the end, and we will wrap up. Lastly, it's not just what goes into your heart, and I don't have time to go through all this. It's also what you allow to leave your heart. One of the most common commands in the Old Testament is remember. Remember, remember, remember. If you read the book of Ephesians, people break down the book of Ephesians this way. 1-3 is what's true. 4, 5, and 6 is what you do. That's kind of the easy way to break it down. There are no commands in Ephesians 1, 2, and 3 except one. There's only one command, and it is remember. You see the command to remember all over Scripture. To forget God's words and actions, you can see this in Deuteronomy especially, is literally in Hebrew to let them depart your heart. You were not taking these thoughts captive and implanting them in your heart, and therefore you forgot them. They fled from you. This obviously implies that our heart can forget things. This is why it's so important to consistently be striving. And Rick Holland says it this way. He says, always put yourself in the way of truth. Like, one of the reasons Sunday morning is so important for me is because I want to put myself in the way of truth. I want truth to come steamrolling at me every chance I get. You can write these verses down. Deuteronomy 4:9. Isaiah 46:8 talks about recalling something to our heart. And there's also commands like Ecclesiastes 11:10. We're commanded by God to get something out of our heart. So your heart isn't fueled by just what's in there. Your heart's also fueled by what's not in there. Are you missing something you should have? Are you letting something slip out? I mean, let's say that you forget to close the storage shed all the way down and earthquake and a box kind of stumbles out. You aren't taking care to make sure it's in there and sealed up and all of that. There's a lot of other verses we can read, but to summarize, our heart is always changing as long as you live. Sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. Everything that we take in and put out of our heart causes us to grow in godliness or live longer in the death that we are no longer in. One guy compared it to this. Imagine you're a slave in a field and you are bought by this master over here and you transition and you're in this field now, but yet you still listen to the master over in this field. It's like, what are you doing? You don't belong to him anymore. Why are you listening to him over there? Again, this is some of the places that we live as Christians. Next week, as I said, Seth will speak about an event in history that sealed the promise that this process of changing your heart, this process of getting everything bad out that shouldn't be there and everything good in it that should be there, is guaranteed to happen, no matter what you think right now. If you're a Christian, it's guaranteed because of some of the things he'll talk about next week. Then I'll return after that to talk about some practical steps to take in order to change our hearts. I want to look at what God's done for us. What has he given us? What are the means for change? What should I be doing? I mean, does standing on one leg help? Does reading the Quran help? I mean, what helps me change? That's what I want to get into. I would say no and no, just to clarify.